Rationalism, Hellenized Christianity and Gnosticism, the fourth talk in a series titled Historical Alternatives to Biblical Christianity, was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 30, 1996, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Series, the Historical Alternatives to Biblical Christianity, we're looking at ways in which people in history, Christians who have called themselves Christians, identified themselves as Christians in the Christian tradition, and yet have nonetheless not really been Christians in the sense that the apostles would think of Christians. Now, so far we've been on relatively safe ground because we've looked at the Christians in Galatia who weren't really Christians, and ways in which the Christians in Corinth, maybe they were, maybe they weren't Christians, but boy, were they messed up in their understanding of Christianity. And we know that they were both messed up on apostolic authority, because we were actually looking at things in the New Testament where the apostles themselves are taking on their misconceptions and their ways of misconstruing the faith. Now from here on out this quarter, we're going to get more controversial because we won't have any apostolic authority to back us up. It's just going to be us, you know, just kind of gunning them down ourselves. So if you want to argue with us, you can. From here on out. You've really done it now. You've bitten off way more than I can chew. So as I was going over this thing and in endless circles of stream of consciousness, I thought, well, why don't I just save time and stand in front of them and do endless circles of stream of consciousness rather than do this twice. So that's probably what it's going to be tonight. What I want to look at is the impact of early Greek thought on Christianity. And to sum it up, I think that there's a good side to the influence of Greek philosophy on early Christianity, and there's a negative side. And I will probably dwell on the negative side rather than the good side, but I just want to acknowledge both right up front. Who was it I was talking to? I was talking to someone just this past week who was talking about, or I heard someone, I don't know if it was the radio or what, but talking about how wonderful it was that Aristotle came along and kind of gave Christianity his philosophy because they had said that God had prepared it. God had prepared Aristotelian philosophy for just the time when Christianity came along, because Aristotelian philosophy allowed Christianity to, gave it the tools that it needed to develop its theology and emerge as the Christianity that we know, and that God wanted to emerge. I think there is some truth to that. Now, it's not so much that that Aristotle developed a philosophy. I mean, the thing that's lasting and permanent and enduring about the contribution of Aristotle is that Aristotle's philosophy incorporates a huge amount of common sense. It's the fact that it is a commonsensical philosophy that it has made it have the kind of lasting impact that it has down through the centuries, I think. He was a smart man. He was a deep and profound thinker, and he said a lot of good stuff that can help us all today. He's just speaking to human beings, creatures created by God, about the reality that God created around them. And to the extent that he got it right, then Christians and non-Christians alike are going to look at his philosophy and go, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So in that respect, Greek philosophy did, in fact, how should I put it? It dovetailed very well with biblical truth. In many respects, there is no incompatibility. And Greek philosophy can help us and can serve us and can aid us in our quest for the truth of truths in Christianity, on the one hand. On the other hand, at a deeper level, many of the assumptions of Greek philosophy were, I think the best word for it is eccentric. And I mean that sort of literally, off-center. They were true, but not really quite on the mark. I mean, it's not what they're saying is altogether false. They're based on true observations of the nature of human beings, but they're inflated, they're exaggerated, they're distorted. It's a, you know, it's a circus mirror image of a human being that is the basis of their view of the world. That'll make a little bit more sense as I describe what it is. And to the extent that that got brought into the understanding of the Christian faith, I think the early foundations of the church built on Greek philosophy has been misguided and misdirected from the get-go. So by and large, my judgment on the impact of Greek philosophy on the Christian tradition has been that it has been decisively negative, and it would have been better had it never happened. But hopefully what will become clear, and interact with me tonight and make sure you're understanding me, make sure you're understanding the implications of this, but hopefully by the time we're done, what will be clear is that we are still living with many of the, much of the fallout, thank you, outfall. A lot of the fallout of Greek philosophy having steered Christianity in the course that it did. I think in the title that you have, I'm not going to stick to this specifically because I think it's better to look at sort of discrete contributions that Greek philosophy made, and I won't try to argue this point. But roughly, all of them sort of fall under the category of rationalism. Greek culture, Greek philosophy, was rationalistic in a certain kind of way, and everything I think ultimately follows from its rationalism. Now, let me make a disclaimer at that point. Anyone who wanted to criticize me and my teaching would likely, one of the first things that would come to mind is, oh, that Jack, he's a rationalist. And that's the four-letter word that they would fling at me. And rightly so. I mean, I want to be clear, I'm not against reason. I am, in fact, a rationalist in my perspective in many, many respects by certain definitions of that. I believe that there is no distinction between faith and reason. Faith is eminently rational, based on evidences, based on proofs, based on reasons, based on evidence. Did I say that? Whatever. Faith, in fact, what I will argue, is one of the contributions of Greek philosophy. A kind of backdoor kind of influence was to make a distinction between faith and reason as alternate ways of believing. And I am completely against that. There is no alternate way of believing. There's one and only one way to believe, and that is by reason, by God-given, commonsensical reason. It's a very popular and common notion, I mean, incredibly popular and common notion today, that faith kind of takes over where reason leaves off. And it goes so far as to, in some people's thinking, to be the belief that faith is somehow a virtue if it involves believing against the evidence, certainly without evidence, and even against the evidence. I remember growing up in the church, in the church culture, I certainly had that impression at times, is that you know, if something was really, really, really stupid and you believed it, then more power to you. I mean, that it really took a lot of strength to believe something that was foolish and was ill-founded and had no evidence and had no reasons why you should believe it. But the fact that you go ahead and believe it anyway was somehow made you a really spiritual person. Well, that's the furthest thing from what I think the Bible would say, the furthest thing from what the Bible would teach.
Pausing there about the rationalism and the not necessarily simplistic, but rational evidences we have for our faith, and where is the hesitance for man to, I mean, we all often talk about the hesitance of man to accept the faith of the Christian faith because they are hostile toward it, yet it's completely rational. So therefore, where do you feel the hostility comes in?
And to hostility to reason?
Just for, not necessarily hostility to righteousness, but yes, hostility to reason. And how does that fall out with the Greek way of thinking? Why are they resistant to reason?
Overt hostility, I mean, historically, overt hostility to reason is a relatively modern phenomenon. The Greeks were not at all, they were very friendly toward reason, and their impact on the Middle Ages for hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, I don't know if you have this perspective or not, but all of medieval theology was, it was Greek philosophy that was the piper playing the tune to which the medieval theologians danced. I mean, there was just, philosophy was, for some of those theologians, for a while, philosophy was considered to be the queen of the sciences. Later it became theology that was the queen of the sciences, but it started off for some of them being philosophy. And they called, whenever they wanted to refer to Aristotle in the Middle Ages, like Aquinas, one of the most important and influential theologians in the Middle Ages, he would just refer to him as the philosopher. I mean, everyone knew who you were talking about. Well, Aristotle, of course. Because everyone read Aristotle. That was their education. I mean, they read his logic. They read his categories. They read his ethics. I mean, just their education was to read and study and learn Aristotle. So he ruled supreme for hundreds of years. And that's why I'm... Okay, so the Middle Ages was equally friendly toward reason. You move out of the Reformation into the early modern era of intellectual history, and you have people, you have the rationalists like Descartes and Leibniz, who are very, very friendly with reason, much friendlier with reason than they ought to have been. And then it's not until, well, I mean, through the Enlightenment, they're friendly with reason. The idealists following the Enlightenment are friendly with reason. Wow, where did it happen? You know, in this century, I mean, early part of this century, is the first time that you begin to get people misconstruing what people like Kierkegaard said, and who begin to exalt irrationality as some virtuous and amazing and wonderful kind of thing. So it's a really relatively modern phenomenon that people would overtly oppose reason. I suppose throughout all of human history, people have, in subtle ways, been opposing reason, but not actually explicitly stand up and glorify irrationality.
And when you say reason, you mean, would you go as far as to mean creature-creator relationship to the universe? Or not, it doesn't go that far?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
I mean, is that a part of given reason that we are a creature of a creator? And historically, through the Middle Ages and all the way up until the moderns?
As
a building block to the philosophical thought, as an assumption.
You mean, would that be considered a reasonable assumption
right.
for them? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even though the Greeks weren't Christians, they had comparable kinds of understanding of the relationship between the world and what was ultimate, as we do. So, in terms of where does that come from, I don't know. That's a good question. I don't think I have a good answer to that. What astounds me, I mean, it wasn't long ago that I was in a conversation with, or I overheard a conversation where someone who I think was a Christian, someone was talking about evidences for some aspect of the Christian faith, and one of them had suggested that there weren't very many evidences, or too many evidences. And the other person's response was, well, that makes sense, because if there were, then it wouldn't require faith to believe it. And that's an incredibly common response by Christians today. And it's, you know, it's the kind of thing that drives atheists crazy, as well it should. Or, a lot of non-Christians, as well it should. I mean, you mean the fewer evidences, the better? I mean, is that what we're saying? And yeah, that's what a lot of people are saying. So why Christians would have the kind of hostility to reasons and faith and evidence that they do, that mystifies me. I don't quite know where that's coming from. But it's just it's so ingrained in popular Christian culture today that it's somehow a virtue, and that we want to keep that virtue alive. Denise?
Well, I guess I thought it was kind of the child of skepticism that gave birth to the whole, you know, God is dead, truth is dead, objective reality is dead, that really has come into full flower in our time. Is that wrong?
Wrong that that's the source of it, you mean?
Yeah.
I'm sure it's related to that. What he's asking about, though, I think, is the hostility to reason. See, a skeptic is not necessarily hostile to reason. He'll say, well, here's how far reason can take us, and it can take us no longer, and it's my reason that tells me that I don't know what I don't know.
But isn't skepticism also saying, ultimately, and correct me if I'm wrong, that fundamentally we can't know?
Yeah. But I still don't think that's the same. See, that's not making a virtue out of irrationality, because your typical skeptic doesn't go, you know, I can't know, but boy, am I strong, I believe it anyway. That's not what your typical skeptic, how they respond. But that's how your typical Christian today will respond, mm-hmm. is that I'll pat myself on the back for believing something that, you know, lo and behold, it doesn't have any evidence for it. Isn't that great?
But isn't that the same leap that the existentialists made on the heels?
Yeah, the existentialist theologians, like someone like Karl Barth, they're some of the first people to really make that explicit. I talk like I know what I'm talking about. As far as I know, those are the first people that I can think of who make that kind of virtue out of an irrational leap, an irrational jump.
And to me, that makes sense. I mean, if the fundamental premise is we can't know objective reality, then it doesn't really make sense to me, but I understand then that I can see how people would.
But see, I think I'm thinking out loud here. I think the missing piece, what you have to add to the skepticism alone would just leave you agnostic, I think. But if you add to it an increasing emphasis on the universe centering on me as an individual, the whole idea that reality is what I think it is, and I create my own reality, and I make my own reality, that kind of language, which you began to get an increasing emphasis on over time. You put those two together. You know, my reason doesn't tell me I couldn't know anything that's objectively true, but what I can know and what is true is what I experience, is what is true for me, what is. And I think there we're in the ballpark of, and certainly we're exalting subjectivism, and if my subjective beliefs are irrational, then hey, I'm into irrationality. And since God is too, it's a virtue.
In fact, if you say that reason is an art or a science,
an art.
And so art, reason in of one person may lead to faith, and reason of another person may not lead to faith.
Right. Right. In terms of an intellectual belief in the truth of Christianity, I'm using reason very broadly, in the way that you're describing as an art. There's a lot of intuition that goes into it. There's a lot of intangible things that go into us as reasoning people coming to the conclusions we come to. And it's not automatically going to lead to the same thing for everybody. We're affected by all kinds of forces and all kinds of non-rational factors go into my reasoning. At this point, I'm just talking about faith as a belief, not as a spiritual reality. That's a whole other question. But believing in the truth of Christianity as truth, one person will come to believe that it's true and another person won't, based on very much the same kind of evidence, because they weigh the evidence differently. And ultimately, I think they weigh the evidence differently for moral and spiritual reasons. But as far as they're concerned, that may be invisible to them. It just doesn't make sense to them. They don't look at the world and see the obvious hand of a designer God, creator God. They just don't. Now, we might suggest that down underneath, behind the scenes, is a moral, spiritual rebellion at work. And I think that's true. But as far as they're concerned, they're not compelled by it. It just doesn't make any sense to them. Dan?
Could it possibly be springing out of the Darwinist age where science was trying to fulfill its own, you know, ideals, and therefore, if you were to be anti-science, that was more in line with your Christian faith, and it's more of a irrational, knee-jerk response to not wanting to have anything to do with the scientific approach and just going off on faith.
Yeah, that's a good observation. I think that
as a war against scientific look at it.
So you're talking about mysticism then, for instance, or the pietist movement?
I don't know.
I think he's talking more about kind of modern conservative Bible-believing fundamentalist Christianity.
Right.
That when fundamentalism had its... What do you have against the ropes? Your back?
Yeah, sure.
I'm having a hard time.
Let's get our metaphor.
I'm having a...
Up against the ropes.
There we go. That's it. Yeah. Back to the wall. Up against... I hate metaphor deficiency, too. Where was I? Okay, when fundamentalism was up against the ropes in the time of Darwin, I think there was a kind of very... They felt intellectually inferior. And they really did have an identity crisis, an inferiority complex during that time. And I think they got really defensive. And that's probably right. One of the knee-jerk defensive moves was, yeah, well, I may be unreasonable, but that's a virtue. And so, that's a good point.
I'll spring it out. There was a Bible teacher that I heard. I can't remember his name. He's from Australia. He said there's radar dishes out towards space looking for a logical sequence of beeps and blips to prove that there's intelligent life, but all they're getting is noise so far. He says all you have to do is look at DNA and look at the perfect mathematical, you know, sequence, and that's a pure sign that there's intelligent life at the very core of our being. He says, how can an irrational, illogical happenstance put something like together like that? Because you don't walk down the beach and find a pile of rocks and assume that it happened there by accident. It's not a random thing. It's a pattern. And he was, you know, that always struck me that he was basically using a scientific approach to try and explain, you know, get back to what we're actually looking at in a scientific way to explain.
A great book on this very subject is a new book by Philip Johnson called Reason in the Balance. If you haven't read it, it's well worth reading.
Reason in the Balance?
Reason in the Balance, I believe, is the name of it. And he's the book is about the way in which law, politics, education, science, that is sort of at odds with reason these days, and it's institutionalized. I mean, that's an incredible example, that the same scientific community that would take a little logical pattern, a repeating pattern from space, and say there's intelligent life out there, can study DNA in the genome project every day, and no, I don't see nothing here that no intelligence here. But it's incredible. I mean, that kind of hypocrisy and that kind of inconsistency is just the tenor of the day.
But it wouldn't occur to many Christians to even use that as proof, because it had to do with science.
Right, right. Okay.
She's been...
Oh, okay.
Before the discussion before about reason, are you saying that someone who is not a believer could by reason come to a belief and a faith in God?
In principle, I think so, yeah. Now, their own rebellion may trip them up, but in principle, I don't see any reason that they couldn't. A wonderful story got told that just kind of illustrates in small measure what I think is true on a larger scale. We had Walter Kaiser from Trinity Seminary here a few years ago speaking, and he talked about being at a graduate seminar, I think it was at
Brandeis.
So Jewish, they're Jewish, right? Is that a Jewish school?
Jewish Harvard, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Was in a graduate seminar at Brandeis University, and they were studying Paul's letter to the Romans in this graduate seminar. And he described it as the best teaching on...
I heard him say that.
Okay, you heard him say that. Yeah, the best sermon he'd ever heard on Romans, and just wonderful. It was so wonderful that one of the Jewish students there at one point raised his hand and say, "But Professor, you sound like you maybe believe this?" To which he let out a few expletives and said, "Oh, God, no, I mean, of course I don't believe this." But I think that just illustrates the point that if an evil, rebellious person has some other way to fend off God and truth, then they have the luxury of being intellectually honest and objective and intelligent and straightforward about the way they look at the evidence. Then they can arrive at it, at least in terms of an intellectual understanding. They can arrive at an insightful and profound intellectual understanding of the truth. It doesn't go deep. It's not something that they embrace with their very being. They just get their mind around it. But having got their mind around it, they can pass it on to you. They can articulate it. Here's what Paul says. Who have got it with their mind.
It seems to be a goal in their life.
Yes.
But maybe it's not a passionate goal, but they shape their life around it, maybe because there's nothing else particularly interesting or enthusing them about some other way that structure their life.
Okay.
And if they go to church on Sunday and do the other things that supposedly are okay, it seems like they're... I mean, I wonder whether that isn't where an awful lot of the things that we criticize or that we think that we see in a lot of churches, that that's not what it is. They haven't found anything that seemed preferable to that.
Mm-hmm.
And it they've grown up with it, it makes sense to them. And so in some sort of a rationalistic approach, they're going to go ahead and follow it because mm-hmm. there's nothing else better.
Yeah. Yeah, hold on to that, because when we get to what I want to say. I think that'll dovetail with what you're saying. Real quick, Logan and Roger.
Well, I can understand the resistance to intellectual or rationalism today because it's associated with intellectualism. And in our culture, when we study the great intellectuals of history, we see believers.
Right.
Newton, Kepler, those guys were brilliant and believers.
Yeah.
These days, the people we hold up as brilliant, the Nobel Prize winners, are always coming out with some New Age nonsense or some abandonment of theological thought.
Yeah.
And so we're very suspicious and tend to want to resist giving them the claim and the virtue of their academia, their intellectual prowess, because we then have to give credence to their disbelief.
Right.
But the church has also responded to that with having embraced mysticism, which is also literally anti-rational. You can't know this; you can only experience it, which is Buddhist.
Right.
And that goes back 600, 700 years.
Yeah.
So it's
I mean, it's like we just keep finding new ways around the same problem. And the problem is that if you use your head, there's only one conclusion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's the ultimate allergy to reason, is that reason is dangerous. Because if you follow your reason, you may end up worshiping God. I mean, not may, but you will. You
must.
Roger?
I can't remember the specific Bible references, but there are things in the Bible that seem to imply that, I mean, God used the foolishness of the world to be the... I can't even paraphrase.
The wisdom of the world is foolishness to God.
What is that speaking to? That's not speaking to irrational. I mean, he's not saying that.
No, God that
decided to do some real funny thing or some real irrational thing and see.
Yeah.
You'd be gullible and fall for it.
Yeah. No, we do have to. It's very important that we make a distinction between reason and human reasonings. And sometimes people use reason when what they mean is human reasonings. Human reasonings involve not just my God-given reason and common sense, but also incorporate all of my rebellious, sinful assumptions, misperceptions, foolishness that just comes out of me as a sinner and an evil person. And human reasonings should not be trusted. That's true. And I think it's a very important biblical theme. Human reasonings should not be trusted. But the problem with human reasonings is not the reason of the person who did the reasonings. It's the rebellion of the person who was using their reason to rationalize their rebellion. That was the problem with human reasonings. It wasn't that they had a broken mind. I mean, sometimes Christians seem to almost be saying that you can't trust human reason because after the fall it was broken. All right. 2 + 2 = I can't get this to work.
We can't divide by zero, so divisions can't be.
Yeah. Clearly our experience is that that's not true. Those non-believers are too smart, not incapable of being smart. They're too smart. They're too smart for their own good, because they use their smartness and their intelligence to destroy themselves. That's the problem.
A lot of this tied with an agenda.
Yeah, absolutely.
It seems to me like I get scared sometimes, real bad, just looking at the political agenda. The agenda for the outcome-based education schooling within the church, I see a real strong agenda to say that, well, to be what is called a neo-evangelical, salvation plus nothing, in other words.
And, salvation plus nothing.
Yes, in other words, the only thing we're sure of in the Scripture is the way of salvation. Other than that, we aren't sure of any other doctrines. And... goes with that thinking from Neil Anderson that if you have a theology, keep it to yourself.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And doctrines...
We're going to breed it at the door.
And doctrines are the reason there's a problem between the church. And as far as the Baptist distinctives, that's what he said. And, I mean, that's an agenda that's within the church.
Yeah.
And it's actively taught that, well... the Bible just isn't really clear on that doctrine. And in the next doctrine... Well,
now, the Bible is clear.
Clear about that doctrine.
The same Bible is clear about the way of salvation?
Yes. With all the various ways thinking about the Trinity, which is beyond the human mind to comprehend, I think, even though you can find verses that say they are, who created the earth, Christ, no, who is Jehovah. How does the mind put that together? And yet, oh, we definitely believe this. But over here on other doctrines, we just don't know. So there's some, this is within our agenda. We must believe it.
Yeah.
And this stuff, it is so engrossed in where we are now with like's been mentioned, the New Age and New World Order and all this stuff coming together, that it just, you know, I feel like a moron because I'm out of step with the rest of the people. Mm-hmm. It seemed like in that I can see these things, and other people say, so what? No, it's fine. Everything going good. Don't make a wave.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. This is a living Alice in Wonderland that we are in right now. I mean, just talk about bizarre. This is a really bizarre culture we're in right now. So,
If there's any doubt whether our epistemology is screwed up, the O.J. Simpson trial is
That's true. That's true. We could probably go on all night on this. This was just a disclaimer that I was making. This is not what I was going to talk about. So maybe we ought to move on before... before I ran out of time. Let's start with Aristotle. And forgive me, Aristotle. I'm going to spend 5 minutes on him. There's just two things that I want to take out of him, because he put it so succinctly. And even though you find this explicit in Aristotle, what I would argue is it's a statement that pervaded Greek culture. Or certainly at least Greek philosophy, Greek thought. Maybe not Greek culture, but Greek thought. It pervaded Greek thought and was just the air they breathed. Aristotle defined man in different ways, but one way in particular, as a rational animal. And what he meant by defining man as a rational animal is that in calling man rational, we are getting to the essence of what it means to be distinctively human. That's at the essence of what it means to be distinctively human. Okay, in keeping with that, then, if rationality has to do with my essence as a being, as a creature, then he says it only makes sense that my end or purpose, the purpose of my existence, has to do with rationality. It's fulfilling my rationality that is fulfilling my very being, in effect. Okay, so how is it then that we find fulfillment as human beings? Well, one is through morals. Now, that may seem to contradict what I just said, but you have to understand that for Aristotle, something was moral because it was eminently rational. That is, you behaved this way rather than that way because it was the rational thing to do. And you behaved this way rather than this other way because it was the rational thing to do. So he ultimately reduced morals to rational living. Now, having said that, his morals weren't too bad. I mean, his ethics is actually pretty good. I think wrong-headed. In many respects, and compared to Christian moral system or Christian ethics, it leaves a little bit to be desired. But for the most part, it's not too bad. But simply because, for the most part, ethics is rational. Or at least there's a tremendous overlap, at least. But that's just the first step. I mean, that's a beginning point, and that's necessary in order to be fulfilled as a human being, but it's really not adequate. That's just the first step. The second step would be to engage in speculative philosophy. Because in speculative philosophy, you are really finding you are really coming into your own as a human being, as a rational animal. You are engaging your reason to understand the very nature of reality, the very nature of everything that is, and you're employing your reason to that end. That's the end of human existence. Now, I'm going beyond Aristotle a little bit, at least I don't remember.
Would that be education?
This? Well, education would prepare you to do this.
Okay.
But really, this is what you do after you're educated, after you've been prepared for it. You engage in speculative philosophy in order to find your basically your fulfillment as a human being. Now, Plato and one of his disciples, a guy named Plotinus, really emphasized, Aristotle was a student of Plato, too. Yeah, Aristotle. He was a student of Plato as well, so there's a lot of class thought going on here. But Plotinus in particular, Plato to a lesser extent, emphasized a third thing, which in the medieval theologians came to be known as the beatific vision. One day I want to study this to make sure that I've grasped this and make sure I'm on the right track. But as best I understand, their concept of the beatific vision at this point is it came ultimately from Augustine, who was early on a student of Plotinus, not a student directly, but through his writings, had read Plotinus and been strongly influenced by Plotinus. Augustine, one of the early theologians and Bible commentators, who, again, was influential for, I don't know, 800 years, I think. 800 years? Yeah. 700 or 800 years in the early part of the Middle Ages, developed a concept of the beatific vision that came out of Greek philosophy. The beatific vision would be that, as best I can understand it, it's that thing that God is going to give you one day where you are going to, in some kind of instantaneous, intuitive flash, are going to understand all things by seeing their answers in the mind of God himself, in effect. You will see God. You will know God. But to know God for him is to know all that God knows, basically. To know God is to know everything. To know God is to have all of your questions finally answered. Now, who could make this up except people like me who devote their lives? I mean, someone like Augustine, someone like Aristotle, someone like Plato, you can actually, if you put yourself in their shoes, this could actually make sense, that human fulfillment would be the pursuit of speculative philosophy, because that's their life project. I mean, that's what their life is. That is what defines their life. That is what gives meaning to their life, is the pursuit of speculative philosophy. And the idea that you could be sitting in your study one day and you have a great aha experience, and not only is it the answer to one little math problem, but it's the answer to all the math problems in the whole world, all at the same time. If I'm not an academic, if I'm not a philosopher, if I have not given my life over to the pursuit of doing philosophy and philosophical truth, I mean, I think my response is, you mean you want me to become a Christian for that? I don't think a lot of people really could relate to that. But you can see how a professional philosopher, a professional theologian, could actually find that plausible. Fundamentally, what's going on, it seems to me, is that the Greek thinkers had this eccentric view of the human being. This eccentric view of the human being that took a very real aspect of what it meant to be a human being, namely to be rational, and exaggerated its importance, blew it out of proportion. For instance, taking something as equally fundamental to being a human being, namely goodness, values, righteousness, morality, ethics, and so on. I mean, that's simply as characteristic of human beings as reason is. And what do they do with that? Well, they just reduce it to reason. But in the end, in the long run, from a Christian perspective, I have to challenge whether or not righteousness can be reduced to rationality. I don't think it can. I don't think righteousness is righteous because it's rational. Because it's righteous, and that righteousness is its own thing. It can't be reduced to something else. It is its own primitive term. It's its own primitive concept that cannot be explained or defined in terms of anything else. And we are equally capable of righteousness as we are rationality. And to ignore that and to neglect that is to not really understand the human creature as God made him. Logan?
In his rational moral conclusions, was there a dose of utilitarianism in his criteria? This is better than that,
yeah,
because...
Yeah, a little bit. It's not real well developed, but... Okay.
So how does the beatific vision work itself out in Christianity?
Well, I don't hear... This doesn't seem to be at all a concept that lives within modern evangelical circles. At least I have not run into it. I wouldn't be surprised if it gets reintroduced. But I haven't run into it today. It's still, I presumably, still alive and well in Roman Catholicism. And in any case, I mean, that if our series here is historical alternatives to biblical Christianity, this has been a historical alternative for millennia now. I mean, this is the thing that many Christians throughout the ages have thought was the end of their existence, is to achieve this.
How do you define it?
Well, it's hard to define, but it's basically that gift that God is going to give us in the end, where we are going to come into direct contact with our minds, with the mind of God. I am going to see through God's eyes, in effect.
Is that while you're still alive or in heaven?
Well, in heaven, yeah.
So it's kind of Aquinas thing. In heaven, you just meditate on God and that's it.
You what?
Meditate on God and that's...
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, one reason I'd like to study this is, what did they think you did after this? I mean, does this last a really long time?
This is the reverse of the Big Bang. This is 3 milliseconds before the head explodes.
Yeah, it's just, they don't, I mean, I've never run into anyone who ever gives an extended discussion of it. I mean, they just kind of refer to it, and I have all kinds of questions about it, and I don't know anyone who's answered them.
Wouldn't some of some of the contact I've had with some Christian groups in the past, where they talk about special revelation and couldn't that fall into a similar type category? Because I've heard, you know, some pretty far-fetched stories in the past.
Well, the distinctive feature, what I'm trying to emphasize is the distinctive feature about this is that if it's appealing to you at all, it's appealing to you as a strictly rational being. That is, if Campus Crusade were to have been born during the Middle Ages, their four spiritual laws would have come up with something like, God loves you and wants you to know everything there is to know. And if you're so inclined, that's going to be attractive and appealing to you. And maybe that was just so much a part of the culture that had some kind of immediate appeal. But, you know, try that today on the college campus. God loves you and wants you to know everything there is to know. Great. I mean, yeah. Well, not really. See, it strikes us outside that culture as having such incredibly limited appeal. But it was very compelling to these people. And my point is, why was it so compelling? Because they had been schooled in Greek philosophy, they breathed the air of Greek philosophy, which from the outset is saying, that's the whole point of our existence. That's what it means to be a human being, is to be a rational creature who wants to know and who will only be satisfied when he knows.
Could you only get there if you were one that was involved in the speculative?
Well, no. I mean, if you take someone like Augustine, and this is my second point. If you take someone like Augustine, the problem is you look at life and you see the intellectuals who are engaged in theology and doctrine and speculative metaphysics and philosophy and stuff, And they seem to have an inside track here. What about all those people digging ditches and making bricks and doing all the grunt work in society? Are they not going to get there? Well, you see, there's two ways. There's two ways to God. There's reason, engaging in speculative philosophy, and there's faith. And the little guy, the non-intellectual, the Dumbo out there, he's not capable or not inclined to pursue the way of reason, but that's okay, because God in his love, and this is how Aquinas talks about it, God in his grace and his mercy and love has provided this other way, that all they have to do is have faith. You have to ask yourself the question, well, what are we talking about? What is that? But all they have to do is have faith, and in the end, they may not get anywhere toward this beatific vision in this lifetime, as the theologian is. I mean, he's sort of making progress toward that in his own limited, finite kind of way. But nonetheless, in the end, even the man of mere faith will be granted as a gift the beatific vision along with the philosopher, the theologian. So that's why I say, you know, you'd think that with the rationality of Greek philosophy, you'd think that they would want to maintain that faith is eminently rational. But quite the contrary, when this gets translated by the Christian theologians into their theology, you get this huge split between faith and reason, because not everyone can prove the existence of God. But even the one who can't prove the existence of God can, by faith, believe it anyway. Now, what did they mean by faith? Well, as near as I can tell, when you read Augustine, he means believe it because the church tells you.
Makes sense.
Because people smarter than you have figured it out
yeah.
for you. So just take the conclusion and move on.
So really, at the heart of it, faith is a kind of loyalty. It's directly a loyalty to the church, to the bishop, to the pope, whoever. It's directly it's loyalty to an institution, but ultimately it's loyalty to God, because that's an institution that God has put there. So you can either use your reason to begin to know, or if you can't do that or choose not to do that, just be loyal to the church. Either way will get you there. Okay?
I got two things. Now, this whole thinking, it came through Aristotle and also Plato, who, right, it was sort of a combination of
Aristotle was a student of Plato. Was literally a student of Plato's. Plotinus was several decades later, centuries later, but he also considered himself to be a disciple of Plato and a more faithful disciple of Plato than any of the others. And Augustine, Saint Augustine, who, by the way, I have a great deal of admiration for. I mean, I think Augustine really was a New Testament biblical Christian who really understood the faith. But the way he articulated that faith, I think, got all messed up and confused with these, what I think are basically alien categories. So he articulated his faith in terms of these categories that were handed him by Greek philosophy and confused the issue. I think that was the problem.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, and I don't know if this, I may be off base with this, but something has flipped into my thinking when you were discussing this. When I was growing up back in the late 60s, early 70s, some of the popular thinking, and I think still is, was that, okay, you receive Jesus, appear as a mental or whatever type of experience you're having or whatever, and the idea was that, I remember hearing someone say, well, okay, this person's out here taking drugs and he's doing whatever he wants to do. He's really living a life of hell, basically. And their concept is, well, they prayed the prayer and they're ultimately going to get into the kingdom or they're going to be saved. And I don't know, it sounds almost like a similar type of a thinking too. I don't know, maybe I'm off, I don't know, but it sounds like, you know, they're saying that the person who really makes the attempt to try to at the virtual type of living and speculative philosophy or whatever, and tries to really get into the Christian life, and then the person who doesn't really do that, but yet he's prayed this prayer and he's gone forward in a church meeting or something like that, he's still going to get in through the back door.
So just like the Middle Ages had the man of faith and the theologian, we have the one who's accepted Jesus by praying the prayer and the disciple who's sort of serious about being a disciple. I mean, that you see an analogy there. Yeah. Well, yeah, in the sense that it is analogous in the sense that you have that kind of two-level... a gold card version. Thanks. Thank you. A gold card spirituality. But it's a different distinction. Do you see that? It's based on a... That, I don't think, is based on any sort of particular exaggeration of the role of rationality, for example.
You don't think some of our more modern thinking like that could have been passed down somehow?
Well, yeah, in subtle kinds of ways. I mean, just even thinking in terms of those, there being a two-story spirituality could get passed down and then get filled in later with different content. Yeah, who knows how subtly some of this stuff has influenced us, yeah. I think that's possible. But it's been transformed. I mean, I don't think that's the same kind of distinction that they were working with. It's been transformed into something else.
With Augustine's definition of faith, then, what did the reformers do with the solo fide? And were they using faith in the same way that Augustine was using it? Or?
No, in fact, Luther makes a big deal about, he talks about the different Latin words for faith, and he makes it, well, actually Augustine does too. In fact, he gets it from Augustine. But ascensus, I think it is, and fiducia are two different Latin words, and Augustine actually has those occur in a growth toward true salvation. You begin with ascensus, but you end up later with fiducia, which is more like trust. And Luther made a really big deal out of we are justified by fiducia, not ascensus. That is making a distinction between it's not just intellectual assent to these things, but it's a real living trust. See, that in Augustine, that's where you see the real Christian coming out, when he makes those kinds of distinctions and that kind of discussion. He's really right on, I think. I mean, he really is in tune with New Testament Christianity at that point, I think.
That kind of reverses the roles.
Reverses the roles of...
Well, I mean, if one is saying that rationality is the essence of being human, and you arrive at a definition of what it means to be the ultimate human being, and then you have the faithful. Defining, from what I understood, that's the essential part, giving a mental assent to the faith. Fiducia would be the reversal, would be like putting, like the guy, the bricklayer, is actually in a better spot, because what else is he going to do all day while laying bricks, but to gain some kind of common sense and have this and trust in his common sense view of the world, which puts him in a better spot, because faith really ultimately is believing in the primitives of thought rather than it's kind of a reversal in a way.
Yeah, and I don't think Augustine would ultimately have had any problem with that, but that's where I think you see a tension in someone like Augustine. On the one hand, the philosopher in him wants to say the bricklayer couldn't do that. But the Christian in him says, well, of course he could. And I think that's why you see a tension that's hard to put together, is that you see sometimes he's speaking like the philosopher with the assumptions of Greek philosophy, and sometimes you see the Christian speaking, I think. Augustine wrote a ton, and I mean, it's difficult to. I'm just, without actually spending a lifetime of scholarship in Augustine, it's difficult to say anything with any confidence about what he did and didn't believe and how much he resolved some of these things that look like tensions to me. I mean, he may very well have resolved them, but I've just barely scratched the surface on.
But your point mainly is that this is the historical schism between Russian.
I think so. It sure looks to me like. Actually, the distinction that I was making gets explained by Aquinas, 100 years later than Augustine, who was sort of a student of Augustine in a way, than it does by Augustine, and so it's probably more characteristic of Aquinas than Augustine. Logan,
in a way, this dovetails with something Ron was saying earlier. You say if you were to go onto a college campus and say, "Hey, how'd you like this beatific vision?" And they'd go, mostly they, well, how much will I make? And if you were to go, on the same token, if you were to go to any college campus today and say, "Hey, how would you like moral glory?" And they'd go, "No."
Right.
How much can I make? What they are pursuing, at least in this version of it, is not what Christ was offering.
Right.
What we have preached for so long is also not what Christ is offering. Right. But that's what people are responding to. The thing we are selling them that they are finding attractive, that they want, is not the salvation that the Bible talks about.
Right.
Which makes me really nervous.
Right.
Because either the rationalist or the mystic, and this guy, and the Buddhist, and a lot of people I've read, all want the same thing. They want this instant annihilation of self, in a sense. They want this oblivion. They want to dive into this pool of euphoria and just stay there for eternity.
Yeah.
Now, on the one hand, they have part of the problem, right? They are the problem. Their self is the problem. And in what they are pursuing, they're going to extinguish that self. These people are going to extinguish their ignorance. Someone else is going to extinguish their pain. You know, and someone else is, and on down the line until they're all just swimming in this pool of euphoria. But that's not what the Bible pictures as the kingdom.
Right.
Now, when you go out to people and give them a clear picture of the kingdom, you tell them about moral glory, and if they don't respond to it, then what do they really want to begin with? And to build a congregation on come to Jesus, you'll never be lonely again. Things go better with Christ. Someday we'll be one. We'll be one with God. It will feel so good. I mean, that's what we do. We've done.
Right.
And we're offering people not what the Spirit of God is creating a desire for, according to what Jesus said. You know, my sheep know my voice. They hear me. I go to see those whom my Father has called, etc. What if we understand the gospel to be this payment of our moral debt and delivery into us of moral glory? None of these people were pursuing that.
Right.
None of these people were finding that attractive.
Yeah. Now, as I was saying, I think Augustine probably was. And then he was trying to translate that into these terms, but the language of Greek philosophy is not adequate to express what is actually going on in his life. I think that, but sometimes he speaks very eloquently to what is really going on too. So, you know, he's kind of a good guy, bad guy, good cop, bad cop theologian. Yeah. But that raises, you've put your finger on another point that I wanted to make, is that it seems to me that you have here a real impetus toward a concept of human fulfillment that I would call, roughly call experientialism. That what finally and ultimately fulfills the human being? Joy. That answer, that version of Christianity says ultimately, joy is fulfillment. Now, you might define the nature of that joy or where that joy comes from differently. It may come from union with God. It may come from oneness with God. It may come from fellowship with God. It may come from whatever. I mean, different theologies may articulate what the source of this joy is, but what they all have in common is that in the end, we are going to enter into this experience of permanent, lasting joy. The pool of euphoria that you were talking about. And that's a wonderful image. I mean, I think it really captures the way we so often conceive of the Christian life. And I have to confess, I mean, for the most part, that's a very, very strong image. And for the most part, that's what I'm assuming. Until I stop myself and I say, now, wait a minute. Where has it ever said that there will be permanent, endless joy in the kingdom of God? Now, that's not to say it's going to be a disaster. I mean, I'm not, just because it may not be permanent enduring joy doesn't mean it's going to be a real bummer and why are we wasting our time? But were we made for joy fundamentally? Is that what fundamentally fulfills me? Or am I actually, when all is said and done, fulfilled by something quieter than that? Maybe in the kingdom of God, joy will come and go just like it does here. Is that okay with us? I mean, is it possible that I could be whole, that I could be fulfilled, that I could be real, that I could be, and there's a lot of different ways we could describe it, but is it possible that I could be a fulfilled human being without being perpetually and constantly in joy? And my answer to that is, yeah, I think so. I mean, fix me. And even this life ain't half bad if I were fixed. It's the fact that I'm broken that makes this life such a disaster for all of us. And the world is inadequate. I mean, the world, there's futility in this world. But remove the futility of the world itself and fix me, and I think my emotions can take care of themselves. But that's not your typical image of what the ultimate blessing is. And you see it in a nutshell right here in the beatific vision. I mean, like I was saying to Ken, they don't define it, they don't describe it, they don't analyze it for you like you'd want them to, but you sure walk away with the impression that it's going to be this wow! Incredible burst of joy is what it's going to be. And they use that language. I mean, they describe it as being joy, this burst of joy. But, you know, there's this incredible sense that you have, and then what? I mean, is the rest of life going to be, like, anticlimactic or what? I mean, what's going to go on from there? I guess the simple answer is, well, it never ends. I mean, it's this endless burst of joy. Well, I suppose that sounds wonderful, I suppose, until you actually stop to think about it. I mean, look at your own heart. Is that really what I want? Endless joy? I mean, just going from my own experience, seems impossible, almost contradictory. Yeah, exactly. Endless joy would be downright boring, I think. What makes joy wonderful is because it's so rare. I mean, because it sneaks up on you, because it's serendipitous. It takes you out of the mundaneness of the rest of your life. And I suspect that that'll be true in the kingdom of God, just as it is here.
But that is one of the things we are made for.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
The thing we are made for.
But not the thing, exactly.
And we will also be rational, we will also be morally righteous, we will also be learning, we will also be doing all these things. But not any one of them becomes the end of our existence.
Yeah, exactly. That's as I was thinking about this, I was thinking now, trying to think like a New Testament Christian, how would a New Testament Christian answer the question that Aristotle was trying to answer when he said man is a rational animal and that the end of man is his rationality? How would the New Testament answer that? And I came up with the same answer. I think it wouldn't try to eliminate any of those features of what it means to be a human being. It would incorporate all of them. And I think that's why the Bible describes it simply as life. And that life is itself, if you were way back in the fall in the first class, I tried to argue there that I think life ultimately is a primitive concept, a primitive term. It cannot be defined in terms of component parts. It's ultimately its own thing that you cannot reduce to something else like reason or joy or whatever. It, on the one hand, it incorporates all of those things. On the other hand, it's different. It's just what existence is going to be when existence is what God ultimately intended for existence to be for a human being in the age to come. That's what life is. And yes, there will be joy. And yes, it will be rational, and we will be rational. And yes, we will have bodies, but they will be different, and, you know, right on down the line. Roger?
In my study of Philippians, I think I'm seeing Paul saying that Christ was the perfect example of a human being. And if he was our model of the perfect human being, he wasn't always in a state of joy.
Right.
He went through a lot of sorrow, and he looked at us and said, I saw the sheep. I mean, there was a knee cry over.
Of course, the argument would be that was Jesus before his glorification.
And that was Jesus at the fall of the world.
Yeah. But I you're right. I mean, nonetheless, I think you're right. Is that's exactly right. That Jesus, the perfect human being, was not constantly in a state of joy. And there wasn't anything wrong with him for not being there.
I'm not going to slow you down. I'm going to speed you up.
Okay.
In the little subject matter of the class tonight, we talked about Hellenism and Gnosticism.
Gnosticism. I'm going to go to Gnosticism.
Touch on some of this before.
Let's see. What have I not? Okay.
Before that.
Before that. Now, notice this emphasis in Aristotle on speculative philosophy. Think back in your church history. What is the only thing the early, at least as far as we know in terms of the records, the written records, the people who made it into history in the early stages of the Christianity, what's the thing that preoccupied them? Well, that was strictly and distinctively Christian. Well, Trinity and Christology. Trinitarian doctrine and Christology. Analyzing the relationship between God and the man Jesus. Was it one nature? Was it two natures in the same body? You know, those kinds of issues. They basically, in those early centuries, they defined Christian orthodoxy for all the rest of history up to the present day. They defined it. And they defined it largely in terms of how do you answer the speculative question? I mean, we're going to engage in speculative philosophy here, right? We're going to go way beyond anything the Bible even talks about, let alone answers. And we are going to speculate on these two questions in particular. What's the nature of deity? Let's speculate about that. Drawing on biblical evidence, yeah, but let's speculate. And let's even speculate in terms of the relationship between, having identified three different persons in the Godhead, let's then speculate about their interrelationship with each other. Now, stop for just a second. Lay your emotions completely aside. Allow yourself the luxury just for 3 minutes here of experiencing heresy in all of its glory. So I mean, just no holds barred, no boundaries here for just a second. We can put them up later. Can you honestly imagine a discussion between Jesus and the apostles about the subject of the Trinity? You see what I'm asking? I mean, I'll give you my answer to it. My answer to that is, if I step back away from my tradition, if I lay aside my preconceptions, it just seems like the most bizarre thing in the world that of all the things to spend our church councils to travel across the Roman Empire to discuss an issue, of all the things to discuss that I find in the pages of the Bible and the pages of the New Testament, of all the problems to solve, of all the problems to hammer out, the Trinity? You see what I'm... You see my puzzle? Or do you not see my puzzle? Help me. Give me some feedback.
You see your puzzle.
You see my puzzle. Thank you. I see that.
There's no chapter in Paul's letters dealing with it.
Yeah.
Paul didn't have a problem with it.
Yeah, the New Testament is completely silent on the subject.
The apostles, the disciples one time asked Jesus, show us the Father. And Jesus said, well, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. So isn't that a discussion about the nature of divinity?
Okay, let's take that scenario. Why do we not have Peter or Philip or Thomas or somebody? Could you articulate for me the relationship between your nature and the Father's nature for me, please? Are you one? Are you like one nature and two different persons? Or you don't have any kind of follow-up discussion or dialogue about that, mm-hmm. right? And yet, they traveled the ends of the empire to ask and answer that question in the early stages of Christianity. That's what I'm puzzled by. I'm not puzzled by who are you, Jesus, exactly, and on whose authority are you speaking, and how do we know God? I mean, those are very, very real, personal, important questions that a human being wants answers to in order to relate to God. But what I would maintain is it's this influence of Greek philosophy that leads them to find it entirely acceptable and entirely appropriate and entirely necessary to pin down with some sort of exact precision, well, is it homoousia or homoousia? What exactly is the relationship between these natures, and do they intermingle? And I mean, the language is even taken from Greek philosophy, straight out of Aristotle. The questions are taken straight out of Aristotle. If it weren't for Aristotle, the questions may not have even arisen. They wouldn't even know how to ask the questions that they answered if it hadn't been for Aristotle. And why would they care to do that? Well, that's what the philosophers did. The philosophers that they admired so much, were what they were really preoccupied with is, what is the nature of being? What are essences? What is real and what is not real? I mean, just all these metaphysical, ontological kinds of questions. So, if that's what the philosophers are doing, and they are fulfilling their role as a human being, if we simply Christianize what they are doing, don't you end up with the Trinitarian discussions and the Christological discussions and so many of those things? I mean, what happened there makes sense if I see them simply imitating Greek philosophy. If I see them as Bible students, what happened there is an incredible mystery to me. Later, in the 15th century, you have wars being fought over whether we're justified by faith or by grace. That makes sense to me. You know, I mean,
because that's a subject that was dealt with.
Because it's a subject that, one, is clearly dealt with in the New Testament and is clearly critical. I mean, it really matters. And it matters in a practical way in terms of the way I'm going to go about living my life right here and now. Does it matter what my view of the Trinity is in terms of how I live my life? The incredible thing to me today is that people, theologians today, keep insisting, yeah, it really matters. In fact, I've heard it said by theologians today that your view of the Trinity literally dictates everything else that you believe. And I want some explanation. It doesn't make any sense to me. It looks to me like you could walk away from those councils having settled the issue of the Trinity, and it's not going to change your life one bit. It's not going to make an ounce of difference. So now we'll spend the whole week on the Trinity later, on Trinitarianism later. But my point for now is just, regardless of what we believe about the Trinity, regardless of how we answer the question, regardless of how important that we think it is, I would like you to at least consider that the level of importance that it got raised to in the early Christian church has nothing to do with Christianity. It has everything to do with the agenda of Greek philosophy, it seems to me.
When I was reading some of the history back then, was that some of the reasons why they did that was because of some of the thought that was coming into the church, and so they were trying to respond. That's the reason why they were having these big debates, trying to establish certain doctrines to counteract. And I don't know whether it was Gnosticism. I've heard some of these councils came about because of Gnosticism. So what I've read, I mean, is that, of course, I know Gnosticism, a lot of it is based upon Greek thinking too.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's along the same lines.
Yeah.
Based out of India and some of these other cultures.
Well, yeah, I guess this is my point. That's true. They were wanting to counteract what they considered to be alien influences of other philosophies. But the question is, at what level? And it was at the level of doctrine, theology, and your belief system. In other words, it was at the level of philosophical speculation. They wanted their philosophical speculation to be right. Not wrong, but right. Orthodox, true. The stuff that the church could all agree upon and could all embrace. But it wasn't even that they were embracing the truth about how you get saved. They were embracing the truth about what exactly is the relationship between the members of the Godhead in terms of Aristotelian categories, in terms of substance and so on. I mean, what exactly, who was and who was not a substance? I mean, do you see how bizarre that is? If you are thinking in terms of the agenda of a Bible student, if you're thinking of it in terms of the agenda of a Greek philosopher, it's not the least bit bizarre. That's what they did. That's how they spent their time.
What I think is really bizarre is if they are trying to, either in this or in any other case, trying to counter Gnosticism, which is based on the same basic system, and yet they're using the same basic system trying to counteract that system. Now that, to me, is really counterproductive.
It could have just been the wrong answer to the right question. I mean, the question of who is Jesus is of utmost importance.
Right.
This, seeing as how they, being the church, owned Jesus, right? I mean, let's face it, they had this kind of thing. We're it.
Right.
It's through us and no place else. They had to be able to say, okay, look, This Hindu Jesus, that ain't Jesus. And this other Jesus, that ain't Jesus. And, you know, all these weird Jesuses we got, like Paul even talked about, which was something he brought up. Many spirits, many Christs out there, he says. Okay, but this is the real McCoy. Now, that's a legitimate question. This, however, may not be the legitimate way to respond to it.
Right.
By codifying, in Greek philosophical terms, a doctrinal statement that anyone who wants to be a real believer has got to agree to this. And Dave's presentation on these councils with the triangles that he kept drawing, I mean, that was real helpful. You know, this group believed that God was apathos, right? He was without emotion. And that was something they were dug in and not going to compromise on. And then this other group says, yeah, but you know, you got God and Jesus crying here. And this reference to grieving the Holy Spirit. So they go, well, on their triangle, they just drew that side of the triangle really short. And so, okay, we can agree to that. But then the other guy, when you hand him the paper to sign the Trinitarian concept, he takes that side, he makes it really big, but he makes this other side of the triangle, mm-hmm. which these guys were invested in, really short. And yeah, I can sign that. So they all agreed to this Trinitarian statement and all went away believing something else.
Right.
So the groups never came... They were able to agree to this three-sided issue, but never agreed what the sides were.
Right.
But I think it's not just speculative philosophy driving them. It's a legitimate question of who is Christ.
Well,
and whose is the real one? They just may not use the right tool to answer it.
Well, but look at how what Paul means when he says there are different spirits and there's different Christs. When he talks about if you look at First John, he's concerned about false teachers who are representing a different Christ really than the Christ that the apostles knew. Well, what did they mean by asking who was Jesus? What they meant, you could answer who was Jesus by answering with what he taught, as far as the apostles were concerned. They're not asking what Jesus taught. They're asking, what kind of stuff is he made of? Is it God juice or human juice? And in what proportion, what mixture, and do the juices intermingle? Or... You see.
Yeah, I do. But I also see that they were bumping into the real question, but they were formulating their question in the wrong terms. Like, here's this guy that comes up and says, "Look, I've been a religious Egyptian all my life. I've served Anubis or Osiris or pick one, you know. And now you're telling me I'm this terrible lost heathen." So this guy goes, "Well, describe this God you've been serving." He starts describing something that sounds vaguely like a loving, creative God. And you turn to the priest and go, "Now, could he actually be worshiping God and just be using the wrong name?" Now, this guy turns around and wants to say, "Well, tell me more about you. Let's find out about the person of the being." But he starts asking the questions in these terms. See what I'm saying? He didn't have terms that he could use that were divorced of this overriding principal issue in the church in order to determine whether or not this guy was actually of faith. His vocabulary was just screwed up. Does that make sense?
Well, maybe.
This guy goes, "Look, we know who Jesus is. So let me tell you, he's this, that, and the other thing. Right? He's made of God juice, not man juice. And does that sound like the person you're worshiping?" And the guy goes, "Sure. Okay, you're in. So pay tithes and you won't go to heaven." And so then a couple months later, they're in Constantinople, and this guy tags along, and then these two guys are having this argument over who's what Jesus is really like. So now this Egyptian convert's going, "Well, now wait a minute. You're telling me he's made of more man juice than God juice, but you told me that I had the right one because I agreed with your idea of the recipe here.
And now I'm out my time.
And now I'm not sure. Right. And see, now I'm not sure, given this belief in this connection to the church, this Lord, I'm not sure I really am a believer here. I may still be lost." See, now they're debating the person of Christ in totally wrong terms. So maybe they're not really debating the person of Christ at all. Maybe they're debating their idol they've created.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say, is that I don't... I mean, it's only in a very external, superficial sense that they're asking the right question, it seems to me. I think they're asking a question that never even would have occurred to the apostles, and then excommunicating people because they give a different answer over it. And it's a question that wouldn't have even occurred to the apostles, and I think the apostles would have dismissed it as, "Now, wait a minute."
So Augustine could have been like the Egyptian. Wasn't Augustine? No. Who was from Alexandria? Who was the... He actually was Egyptian. There was a famous Christian early on. So Augustine could have been like the Egyptian convert who had actually come to the real Jesus, the real salvation, but had loaded the church's beliefs and structures and icons and pictures. And like, it was so invested in his loyalties within the church, he couldn't divorce himself.
That's what I think happened.
And trying to hammer Jesus into this mold.
Yeah.
Whereas some of these other people were never there to begin with. I started out with that idol and just forgot Jesus altogether.
Right.
That's a whole lot of insecurity.
See, you can make Jesus into an occupation. You can write doctoral dissertations on him. You can do seminars on him. You can spend your life studying him. And it has absolutely nothing to do with Christianity. I mean, it has nothing to do with faith. It has nothing to do with what the apostles are talking about Jesus was for. And this was just a first century version, I think, of that. This was an academic Christianity from the get-go. Now, I'm sure that there were real Christians back then. I mean, I'm not challenging that a bit. But they didn't make it into history. They're not the ones that are haunting our theological dreams these days. You know, they just lived their lives and believed and went on to bigger and better things. The ghosts of Greek philosophy entered into orthodoxy, defined for us what Orthodox Christianity is.
But God wasn't out of control. I mean, this happened. He let this happen.
Yeah.
I wonder why.
But what? But
the test for the truth.
I mean, oftentimes, there's one. A church historian discusses the. We should have saved this for. Anyway, here we go. A church historian that I read was discussing the councils that came up with the Trinitarian formulas. And he talked about how political they were, how, it was basically a political compromise. I mean, there's no searching for truth that went on there. It was just, look, I'll vote for your formula if that sort of U.S. Congress type consensus. And it is as clear today as him that that's what went on. How does he respond to all that? Isn't it amazing what God will use to give us truth? Now, okay, maybe. Maybe so. But on the other hand, do we say the same thing about the Phariseeism of Jesus' day? We don't look at that and say, isn't it wonderful that God preserved the truth through these hypocritical, self-centered, self-righteous men? You know, politically motivated. We would never say the same thing about Phariseeism. We would never say the same thing about Sadduceeism. We look at the situation in God's day and say, you know what? Everyone had it wrong except Jesus. Why then do we then all of a sudden turn around and say, isn't it amazing how God, through all this, all these comedy of errors and bumbling idiots and crooks and immoral men and so on, has preserved the truth for us today? Maybe. I mean, I'm not. God could certainly do that, but why do we assume that? And what's most compelling to me is it sure looks to me like I'm reading Aristotle when I read their discussions. And so I say, this looks more like the inspiration of Aristotle than the inspiration of the Holy Spirit to me.
You know what amazes me is, somewhere in the scripture, I can't remember if it's in the Old Testament or it is in the New, where it says that, talking about Israel, that they have not believed, and that he will turn it over to a people who will basically carry it on. And obviously, to my knowledge, he's talking about the Gentiles.
Right.
And then I look at what's happened in the last 2,000 years, and I'm thinking, are we better than the Jews?
When's it going to happen? When's it going to turn it over?
I mean, you know, at least from my perspective, I think we've messed things up pretty poorly. And I'm amazed. I mean, yes, it is better than...
Yeah, that's the question that each of us ultimately have to answer, is that... and I'll let you go with this, but that's the question we have to answer for ourselves, is it like God to just simply plant seeds of belief in the hearts of individuals in the midst of intellectual and theological chaos? Or is that somehow out of character, and that we can automatically assume that somehow, somewhere, there is a pure and true Christian tradition that God has kept alive and has preserved, and all we have to do is find which one of those traditions is it. You're going to answer that one way or the other. You're either going to keep looking for that pure tradition, or you're going to decide, you know, we're all messed up. There's not a single one of us who knows what we're talking about. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, we all have to answer that for ourselves. You can probably tell where I'm leaning. I think we're all messed up. And I do literally mean all of us. I think if I could live long enough, I would look back on what I teach today and go, ooh, I said that. I've already done that in my life. I mean, I think back 20 years ago at what I used to teach and go, oh, I'm sorry.
3 years ago.
So oh, no, that's not your personal. Yeah.
Would you call that a Christian or a philosophy of Christianity? I heard it said that all Christians have a philosophy of religion, whether they like it or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good statement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, even the people who vehemently deny that they ever touch philosophy have a very, very strongly held philosophy of the Christian religion that informs all of their thinking and all of their attitudes and all of their conclusions. We all do. We can't help ourselves. We are all automatically philosophers. Just some of us admit it and some of us don't.
Philosophy then just thought based on whatever rationale that you have available?
Yeah, whatever reasons, whatever evidences, whatever proofs, whatever arguments, whatever concerns, we think about those things. And even if we have decided that I am deliberately never going to think about any of those things, then that's our philosophy of life. I mean, because usually, if you say, well, why wouldn't you do that? You almost always have an answer. I suppose the only consistent non-philosopher would be the one who, if you ask them, well, why don't you ever think about anything, would say, oh, I don't know. Never thought about it. I'm not going to.
Wouldn't this type of response, see, in this framework, I can see people turn into a concept such as mysticism, where you throw your hands up and go, ah, can't be known anyway, so I'll just kind of rely on this personal, warm, fuzzy little Jesus, who I know in deep thoughts and personal feelings and so forth. The God of Romanticism, the God of Schleiermacher, that really is a response to this whole dilemma. Really, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, it is, but it's deeper than that because it's also answering a very, very fundamental question, and that is what ultimately is going to fulfill me. And I think what they're answering is what's ultimately going to fulfill me is whatever joy is going to come out of Schleiermacher's dependence or whatever kind of joy is going to come out of being united with God, being absorbed into God. Or whatever, however they tell a story. They tell some kind of story about what it is that's going to happen to me in the end, and the assumption is that I was made for that, and my real fulfillment is going to come by being absorbed into God, being united with God, seeing God, knowing God, whatever. You're going to tell some story, and you're going to have some answer to the question of why I'm here. And I'm just saying, we need to do the best we can, it seems to me, to tell the story that the apostles tell and to answer the question the way the apostles would answer it, not the way Aristotle would answer it. And we ask the questions, what this is all about the Trinity, and we ask the questions and are preoccupied with the questions that would be questions that the apostles would be preoccupied with. It's just as bad to import alien questions as it is to import alien answers sometimes. Not always, but sometimes. Because in the very process of asking those questions, you end up perverting the philosophy that you're going to answer them out of.
Careful the question you
ask. Yeah, be careful.
So when I think back on Scripture and what was written about maybe church behavior, for instance, the Corinthians, a question about what's poor for me morally is more relevant, apparently,
right,
than the Trinity.
Absolutely. Exactly. That's my point. Their concern,
that's the subject was taken up.
The question they take on is, how should we then live, is the question they take on. Not what's the right balance between...
Yeah.
I need to let anybody go who needs to go. Yeah, please feel free.
Sorry.
But
church fathers were... They didn't have a problem with their moral problems.
Yeah. How do we... Have you ever, like after the David Koresh deal, the big question in the press and the media was, how do you define a cult? What's a cult?
Yeah.
And you read any cult book, and those are the things that they use. If they don't believe in the Trinity, or if they don't believe in the deity of Jesus.
Yeah, that's the thing.
That's a cult. No, actually, what a cult is when Jack asks us to put our dogma down on the doorstep. That's when I started getting willy.
And but this is something I think needs to be said. The 700 or 7,000, was it, that had not bowed their knee to Baal, that Elijah's going on, the only one left, and God goes, oh, shut up, quit whining. I got hundreds out of them. They were not recognizable to Elijah.
Right.
He'd walk through the land and not seen these guys.
Right.
So at these councils and in the history of the church, they've always been there. Just because you can't point and say, oh, yeah, Saint so-and-so or the king of this and such. I mean, they're obviously great. I mean, God's version of church history is going to be unrecognizable when we read it compared to ours.
Yeah.
Because it's going to mention all these people we've never heard of. And it's going to talk about all these heroic, faithful actions. And it's going to talk about martyrs that, you know, didn't make it in the Book of Foxes.
Joe the Tanner.
Yeah, exactly. And God's going to say, they were mine. Yeah. They bowed their knee to me. They just didn't make it in the press, you know.
Right.
And so the church has always been intact. There is a church history. It's just not the one that makes it in the press.
Right. That's a very good, yeah. We have to keep that in mind. I mean, just think about 2,000 years from now, looking back on this time, who are going to be the notables in our age?
David Koresh,
Jimmy Swagger, Robert Schuller.
The Dark Ages.
Yeah. The dark period of the church.
Oh, God.
Back to basics.
Yeah.
That's scary.
So, Jack, you started out this by saying that you thought the net impact of Greek thought on Christianity was negative. And so would you say that negative impact is the emphasis on speculative philosophy and because of that, the split between faith and reason and the emphasis on obscure
and one more
questions
that
like Trinity and Christology?
Well, actually, probably more than... There's several I didn't get to. Probably the most important of the other ones left would be Plato's famous for his theory of ideas. Mm-hmm. And I think that's had a huge influence, through Augustine in particular, had a huge influence on how we think about the church in particular. Because in Plato's theory of ideas, Plato was trying to explain, you know, we've got several chairs here. Why do we look at them and all use this word chair to describe all of these things? I mean, they're different. They're not all exactly the same. He didn't live in an age of mass production. But they're not exactly the same. But why do we use the same word? And he basically said, well, there's this universal, this chairness, and all of these are participating in chairness. I'm oversimplifying him, but that's basically what he was saying. And what that led him to do, and any Platonist after him, was really, were really intent on there being an objective reality out there, an objective reality where the ideal of everything resided. Which is to say, there was an ideal of everything. Okay, most Platonists, or at least when that came into the church, I think, they didn't make any real distinctions at all. I mean, they never really seriously asked themselves the question, well, would that apply to anything and everything? And I think they would just assume, well, yeah, sure, anything and everything. So, well, what about a church? And the Platonists would answer, well, sure, of course. There is this idea of churchness. Now, when you get to the Christian theologians, these ideas are in the mind of God. So, I mean, that's where they exist. They're not floating in midair. They're just ideas in the mind of God, concepts in the mind of God. So the Platonist is going to say, God has this concept of what a church is. And the concept in the mind of God, of course, is perfect. It's unblemished. It's Now, when you get particular churches here on earth, they're going to be imperfect, just like particular chairs are imperfect. Nothing really quite matches the ideal. But there is such a thing as ideal churchness. All right. Well, the next obvious question is, if I'm going to make a church or run a church or do a church, shouldn't I try to make it match ideal churchness? Yeah, I should. Okay, well, what is ideal churchness? So we set out to define it. Well, I mean, is that not the method that is still with us to this day? I mean, Augustine, that's how Augustine thought. And so he was answering questions like, well, here's what makes a church, and here's how a church does this, and here's how a church does this. This is ideal churchness. This is churchness as God would have churchness be. You can read books on the bookshelves, take books off the bookshelves of Christian bookstores today that will set out the biblical view of church. And what they mean by biblical view of church is, here's the idea in the mind of God about what church will be. A true church will have this characteristic and this characteristic and this characteristic and this characteristic, and it'll look like this and look like this and look like this. If it's a Baptist author, it looks like a Baptist church. If it's a Presbyterian author, it looks like a Presbyterian church. If it's Episcopalian, it looks like an Episcopal church. I mean, no one has ever stopped to ask the question, actually, does God have an ideal church in mind, or is it maybe possible that God doesn't care what your church looks like? Maybe God only cares what the people in the church look like, and he really doesn't care at all what the church looks like. Well, if you're a Platonist, it wouldn't even occur to you to ask that question, it seems to me. And through the influence of Augustine in being influenced by Plato's theories, I think, you know, just the reformers never challenged that. They reformed the church because they thought that there was ways in which it had departed from the ideal, but the very reason that they were reforming the church is that they wanted to get it back closer to the ideal. My own view personally is that there's no such thing as an ideal church. Church is whatever a community of Christians who trust God and are seeking to know the truth and are seeking to live their lives in the way that that truth would dictate that they live their lives, however they organize themselves, that's what church is.
What about, we never got into really talking about Gnosticism?
No, we didn't. We didn't.
We're not going to come back, are we?
What I'll try to do is say some words about Gnosticism the next time I show up, which I think is in 2-3 weeks. Can't remember what my topic is. It may be totally unrelated, but maybe I'll say a few words. There's not a whole lot to say. Well, in fact, I can tell you right now. Why not? Is that my next one? Okay. Yeah, that wouldn't be related. the Gnostics were in their day what Masons are in our day. I mean, the closest thing to anything like Gnostics that we have today would be like the Masons. A secret society with secret things that you're initiated into and so on. And it was for the purpose of salvation, ultimate salvation. But they told a story. And the Gnostic story was basically that everything ultimately originated from the One. And there was they tell a longer story about how the world came into being, but basically it came into being because one of the, one of what they call the Pleroma, Pleroma means fullness, but there were these divine beings that were kind of hanging around the edges of the One. Oh, thank you. And one of these divine beings, who was a little further away from the One than the others, got a little uppity and rebelled. And as the other beings set out to punish this One who had been in rebellion. The One who was, some of the different Gnostic sects tell a slightly different story, but one version is that the beings set about to punish let's see, the rebellious one, and yeah, made him into a human being, made of physical stuff, which is evil. And somehow this being set a trap. I don't remember the details, and caught a portion of the light, the one, and entrapped it, encased it in human form. So as you and I walk around, there are two kinds of people that we run into. There are somatikoi and pneumatikoi. The two kinds of people. People who are merely fleshly, who are merely body, but there are pneumatikoi who have portions of the divine light trapped within them. Well, that divine light, in order to save not only themselves, but to save the whole cosmos, that divine light needs to be released so it can return back to the one from which it came. As long as it's trapped in human beings, there's alienation and fragmentation in the cosmos. So the salvation of the world will be the death of the person and the release of the spirit of the light to return. But that light will not be able to return unless it knows the passwords, because this world is basically like a prison and it's guarded by 9 gatekeepers on the 9 different levels of reality. And I need to have a password to be able to pass through each and every level of heaven. So if you pay me $150, I will tell you the first password. Come back next week, give with another $150, I'll give you the second password. I mean, if I'm a Gnostic teacher, I've got something that you need for your salvation. You need the passwords. So Gnosticism, gnosis means knowledge in Greek. The knowledge that they're talking about, that the Gnostics are talking about, is twofold. One, I've been put to sleep, even if I'm a pneumatikoi. I've been put to sleep, and I don't know that I'm a pneumatikoi. I don't know that I am really divine inside. I don't know that I'm really made of a son of the light, a child of the light. I need to be awakened and alerted to that truth about myself. So the Gnostic teacher can tell me that, can alert me to that, can awaken me to my true identity. So that's one aspect of the gnosis that a Gnostic is peddling, is true knowledge of your true divine identity. And then the second thing that's part of the gnosis is you need to know these secret passwords. And in both respects, Gnosticism is arguing that there's a certain kind of knowledge that you need that will spell your salvation.
And that's where the Masons are very similar.
Well, actually, the Masons may be directly descended from the Gnostics. I mean, that there's enough similarity.
There's a hook up between them and Mormonism, as far as I believe.
That's what I've heard, yeah. So that in terms of... and then... in the so-called Christian versions of Gnosticism, Jesus then, his role is he's the one sent into the world from the realm of light, sent down here into the darkness of this world to proclaim the message that we are all sons of light, that we are all children of light, and to awaken us from our slumber so that we can be alert to our need for salvation. So he's simply a messenger, come into the world to enlighten us.
And a lot of that comes from, as my understanding, comes from India and other areas.
Persia,
and that general area. Would it be hooked up to like a Hindu type of, or would Hinduism be also loosely based in some way?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if the roots of Gnosticism and early Hinduism are very similar. Not later Hinduism. Later Hinduism has... more sophisticated, I think, but probably early Hinduism would be very similar.
First Hinduism or that?
Well, I think they just have the same roots. I mean, Plotinus, we didn't talk about him, but Plotinus' view of God is very much like the Hindu view of God, I mean, in many respects. Or God, Brahman. His view of the one, he doesn't call it God, nor do the Hindus. His view of the one is not at all unlike the Hindu Brahman. I think the roots of both the East and West are here in Greek philosophy. In fact, the so-called rift between the East and West, the more I study philosophy, is laughable. I mean, I run into more Eastern philosophy studying Western philosophers than I do Western philosophers studying Western philosophers.
Also, doesn't it come out of Gnosticism, come out of Babylonian type thinking, which is even before, would that be before thinking?
There's no real direct connection that I can see. Only in the sense, see, Babylonian religion was polytheistic, and only in the sense that I think all of this ultimately arose out of polytheism. I think that's true. So in that sense, it would be related to, but it's really become a whole different worldview, a distinctly different worldview. This is not polytheistic. Not really. So that's all I would have said about Gnosticism. I mean,
I was going to ask you earlier in your conversation about 3 hours ago, whatever it was, you mentioned there was a point brought up about the idea that a lot of people believe in the church, and but they have like more of just a rational type belief, and there's not this spiritual type. Obviously, the Holy Spirit who brings them into that heart-type belief and so on. Would you say that that's sort of along the same lines as theism?
Yeah, I think I understand what you mean. In other words, they do little more than just simply, as their theoretical view of the world, believe that there is a God who created the world.
They don't go beyond that, so it's sort of a theistic kind of claim.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's true of a lot of Christians today.
How many is a lot?
Are you being facetious, or are you surprised that I say that?
I mean, I guess I'm not really. I mean, given what I've been listening to on Christian radio, but the people that call in, like, for example, even... I shouldn't mention his name, but what's like Steve Gregg the other day, they were having a discussion about different Bible translations. Because there's a movement out there that says that the King James is the only Bible translation. They're all impregnated with Gnostic philosophy and stuff, because it's a big mess anyway. And Steve Gregg was refuting that, saying that all the translations they're all worthy to be read you can get salvation out of them, basically. And that he just prefers the King James Version. And the reason he prefers the King James Version is because it's the one version that doesn't have a lot of theology incorporated into it.
Tuned.
Wow.
Okay.
who is Steve Gregg?
Steve Gregg is a
Bible teacher from McMinnville.
Yeah.
From McMinnville, from us.
Oh.
See, when you were on, I think a tape that I got, you were on talking about prayer, I think.
Yeah, could be.
A few years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Different languages.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and Steve is not dumb.
He's very intelligent. Yeah.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that he, even a person who's very intelligent and has thought a lot about the Bible, can get in these, I don't know what you call them, mental blocks or something. That, I mean, maybe he didn't really mean to say that, but there are people out there saying things like the English translation, the New Testament, in the King James, is inspired, and that if there's any disagreement between the King James Version and the Greek New Testament, that the Greek New Testament ought to be changed because the English version is inspired.
Have you heard somebody explicitly say that?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
whoever that guy was, 1500 to us. Almost as valuable as the losses.
Well, the King James, who said do it, was supposed to have been involved in homosexuality and all kinds of stuff, at least as I understand.
Oh, yeah, he was terrible.
I mean, he was, you know, so, I mean, it gets right back to the issue that God...